I'm David Sofield, professor of English at Amherst College, where I've been for 45 years, and a colleague of Bill Pritchard's all that time. He came here, must have been 7 years as a teacher, 7 years before I did. But I immediately saw that he was somebody that I could learn a lot from. I'm grateful to others, but I would say that certainly within the department, this is the sustained intellectual literary friendship that has meant the most to me, and it's still going on, and I hope it goes on.
Very good. Thank you.
A lot longer. So, Bill, a very minor regret, but it is a regret that I have, that the wonderful, the exemplary Ohio University Press did not include, opposite the title page, a list of books by you. So I made one myself to remind myself of how many books like this superb book on poets and poetry you've done. And by my count, this is the sixth. I don't know if I have that exactly right, but I think six collections of essays and reviews, plus four monographs. Am I right about this? In order, Wyndham Lewis, Frost, Randall Jarrell, and John Updike. A memoir, The Wonderful English Papers, which is, I think, of properly called a memoir, plus the long introduction to Ted Baird's English at Amherst. And I don't know that there are other books, but there might be another book.
Well, there's another Baird collection, the most of it. That was the first one.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, good. So this is just to remind anybody who's listening to this, wherever people are listening to this, that I'm talking with a really prolific author. I'm sure there are a fair number of uncollected reviews and essays as well. And I've read an awful, I think I've tried to read everything that, you know, because we're friends and we have something like, or really a lot like, similar taste.
You've been very good and very helpful over the years.
Well, thanks, Bill. I'd like to say a few words before we really get into dialogue here about what I think your virtues are as a critic, as a prose writer. I find the prose utterly readable, clear, witty, alert. I've got an example of this that I'm going to read in just 1 second. Never showing off, unlike a fair amount of high modern criticism, at least to my mind, with something like, it's a big word, but something like a genius for the telling quotation, which you use over and over and over again. I was really struck by it in the Hardy essay. Here's my example of the wit. You're writing about fish on Milton. And on page 33, we get the following new paragraph. As I write, How Milton Works, which is the title of the book by Stanley Fish under review here, has been subjected to salient critiques by four respected names, Frank Kermode, Helen Vendler, A.D. Nuttall, and John Carey. And your sentence then, we won't count the anonymous one in Publishers Weekly advising you, improbably, that interested readers, quote, stash this volume in their beach bag. This was a laugh out loud moment for me.
Shows you how close I read Publishers Weekly.
Well, that's good to know, or not good to know. But that's not atypical of what goes on in this book, in my view. I want to say one more word about what I consider the salient virtues of the book. And this is, to some degree, to be sure, a personal confession, but it feels to me as though, or I would judge, that it is your judgment of writers that is as accurate and quite possibly as lasting as anybody's judgment now writing about poetry and about fiction. That's the way it looks to me.
Well, I blush. I blush. I agree with you completely.
Well, our tastes are pretty much the same and have been for the 45 years that I've known you, which is as long as I've been in the English department, and you've been in it longer than that.
I think we had a little disagreement about Billy Collins.
It we seems do. To me we did and we do.
We did and we do. And now, yeah, Billy Collins has gotten to be not quite as interesting as I thought he was earlier.
Ah, to so, you. You're
well, saying the last volume, yeah.
Oh, I'm so pleased to hear that. Well, you've educated me on lots of matters. Looking at the table of contents, essays on older poets, reviewing 20th century poets, the modernist generation, and then the middle generation, and then a third section titled Three Critics of Poets and Poetry, and the critics that you're writing about here in extended essays in each case, 60 pages worth, are T.S. Eliot, Hugh Kenner, and Donald Davey. I wondered about whether you might even have called the book on poets, poetry, and critics, because you give a lot of attention to these critics, to whom you acknowledge your very serious debt in the preface. Eliot, Kenner, and Davy surely invented much of my own, that is to say, my own way of reading poetry. What about other critics? If you hadn't put this book in my hands, I would wonder, and I wondered about that particular list, and maybe it's just that they were the ones in your, so to say, formative years, but there are an awful lot of critics that I could think of as maybe qualifying as hero critics for you.
Let me stay with Eliot for just a minute, because
sure.
the title of the book,
yes,
I immodestly made On Poets and Poetry. One of Eliot's collections is titled On Poetry and Poets.
Right.
And I didn't allude specifically to that, but I'm a little embarrassed by the effrontery in making the making the comparison. But the book, as you know, is pretty much about poets and poems, and whatever
yes.
speculation about poetry there is, and there's a good deal of it in Eliot's collection, is, I think, to the side. But you ask about later critics, or
yeah, well, I just made a little list of critics that I can imagine you have read clearly, and I would have thought learned something from Leavis, Empson, Ransom, Tate, Blackmer, Ricks, Vendler. I mean, the last two are contemporaries of yours.
Put Jarrell in there.
Oh, sorry, it was an oversight. Jarrell, yeah. Absolutely.
It partly was the fact that I had, when I came to gather, had the idea of gathering a book of essays on poets and poetry, I was writing or had written a piece on Eliot's mischievous wit and a long obituary for Hugh Kenner, who had just died, mm-hmm. and had to give in the near future a paper on the criticism of Donald Davy. So this became the third section of the book.
Yeah,
three critics of poets and poetry. I was going to say great critics, but I didn't mean in any way to say that these are the three who
sure.
have meant the most to me.
Yeah.
Although I can't think of any more, and I can't think of any three who have meant any more to me as far as the reading and study and teaching of poetry goes than these three.
Mm-hmm.
Leavis, for example, meant a great deal, but in various other ways, other than
right.
Simply what he wrote about poetry.
Right, right. You have a nice sentence here quoting R.P. Blackmer in the preface. The critic brings to consciousness the means of performance.
And not the first time I've quoted it, I might add. I sort of hope that wasn't beating a dead horse, but nobody seems to remember it. But it's always seemed to me just the right way to talk about what you and I try to do in class, the means of performance, and to feature that word, which involves in class reading the poem aloud at some point, probably early along, and getting students to read it aloud and to recast it, to try it differently, different lines, trying to get it more right. So bringing to consciousness the means of performance takes a little time.
Do I remember, this is an anecdote that you may have in your book on Frost, or you may not, I don't know, but when Frost was teaching at Amherst, must have been in the, early 1930s, when Ben Brower, whom I never knew, but when Ben Brower was a student at Amherst, Frost asked him to read a poem aloud, and he read it, and Frost said, "I give you A for life," or something like that.
Yeah, it was, I don't know how that particular poem got chosen. It's a fairly obscure 16th century poem by a poet named Richard Edwards, who usually is not in the anthology, and it,
right.
and it's called On Going to Bed or something, with and Frost, maybe Brower just said, "Would you read aloud a poem?" That was probably it. Not, "Would you read aloud Richard
yeah.
Edwards?" And,
yeah.
and this
yeah.
happened to be on Frost's mind at the time. He carried around, as you know, many poems like that as talismans. Collins as "How Sleep the Brave," and Shirley, "The Blood, Glories of Our Blood and State Are Shadows, Not Substantial Things." So he read that aloud, and Brower said, "Right, I give you A for life." And our old mentor Theodore Baird always used to snarl when he heard that story. He said, "I don't want to hear about A for Life anymore." but it is a good.
Well, one of Frost's successors as Simpson lecturer, Richard Wilbur, with whom I'm now teaching a class on poetry from 1950 to the present, poetry in English, so British and Irish as well as American, he will ask a student to read a poem. And when a student reads the poem to his satisfaction, I can tell you what he does, and I'm going to demonstrate it here. I hope the audio will pick it up. He goes like this. He doesn't say any words. He says, he slaps the table like that, and that's the form of applause. And you can imagine how a student would beam when that.
Yeah, all I ever say when somebody reads aloud is, "Well, you might have read that a little more slowly."
Well, frequently, because students do read too fast almost always until one tries very hard to slow them down. There are only a couple of essays specifically in the book that I want to turn attention to and to have you speak a little about. And the first one is in fact the fish on Milton. You compose the following sentence: "I find the challenge, excitements, and rewards of reading and teaching Paradise Lost as strong as those I've experienced in any writer, perhaps stronger." I found that the single most surprising sentence in the book. I didn't know you were such a committed Miltonist, and I should have known.
Well, I'm not a committed Miltonist. I came late to Milton. I didn't ever teach Paradise Lost until, 25 years ago or so. But you might agree with me, as a committed Miltonist for longer than I have been, that this does ask for a response and a rise in the teacher critic that no other poem in English surpasses, does it?
Yeah. Yeah, I was just surprised that you were that. I mean, I started making a little list of poets that I know you are very fond of. Mm-hmm. Frost, Yeats, Lowell, Eliot, Larkin, Shakespeare.
Yeah. I think partly it may be too my sense of inferiority there, my awfulness with other languages, my feeble, almost absent Latin and less Greek, and my sense of Milton's great theological learning, of which I have almost nothing, and so that you're always I always feel as if I'm skating on thin ice a bit, and maybe don't quite know enough about what I'm talking about.
Well, I feel that as well frequently. So in that little list of nouns, challenge, excitements, and rewards, I could imagine thinking of the challenge, just getting a contemporary student, even at Amherst, interested in Milton enough to read him seriously and sustainedly. And the reward would be to have achieved that, to get at least some of the students in the class as excited, the third word here.
I think they, if they elect at all to take a course, my course now in a major English writers, Ben Jonson, Milton, Swift, mm-hmm. Pope, a couple of others, early 17th and 18th century, they're excited about Milton, and they want to live up to reading him as best they can.
Yeah.
I don't find, for example, I haven't taught Wordsworth in a while, but there seems to me to be a real challenge, trying to make students really interested and moved by Wordsworth without, what they've been told about him being a great poet. But Milton is he's a dazzler.
Here's a question, a different kind of question, but it comes from my rereading the Hardy chapter, Hardy's Poetry in Old Age. You bring under critical discussion some poems that, although I've been teaching, have taught Hardy a number of times here at Amherst, I hadn't paid much attention to, and that's another one of the great virtues of your book and of your practice generally, that you don't just follow the anthologies, the choices in the anthologies. As I was reading those poems again, especially the poems of 1912-13, I did think of Richard Wilbur, on whom you have a review here of his most recent collected poems, 1943-2004. These are two poets who, would you agree with this claim, are writing at something like top form, it well into their 80s. And Wilbur is 88 at this point. Mm-hmm. Hardy die at 88? It must have been.
Just right? Before he made it to 88, he hoped that his last book, Winter Words, would be published on his 88th birthday, and he left a blank in the in the preface. He didn't quite make it.
Yeah,
certainly agree that Dick Wilbur is writing at the peak of his, and pretty much with Hardy, too. The last volume, Winter Words, maybe is not quite as stunning as the couple that preceded it, but it's also the case with Hardy that he kept, you know, we don't know when many of the poems were written, that he kept them around for a decade sometimes.
Here's a different kind of question, but one that I ask myself periodically as an exercise in self-discipline, I guess. If you had to name a poet, and I can imagine possible answers in your case, whose sensibility, and by sensibility I mean something very large, that is to say, a fundamental way of taking in the world and giving it back in art, giving it back in poetry. Is there a poet whose sensibility you feel most sustained by and most admire, I suppose it would be a simpler way of putting it, a single one?
Well, it's like this above all, to thine own self be true. Which self? Now Larkin sustains my deepest melancholic, misanthropic, all the toys will break self.
I asked the right question. Go ahead.
but then there's Jarrell, the music man, and even he didn't always get the music into the poems, but the love of and the knowledge of the classical repertory, and how that gets alluded to, I felt very close to. And then there's Frost. And then there's Frost, who I'd like to think provides a view of the world that hangs together, and that if I could live up to it. I mean, Frost says, one of the many things he says not in the poem is, respect your insomnia. And I think that's spoken by a man who knew what insomnia was, and it's listened to at the moment by a person who knows what insomnia is. So respect your insomnia. That's the way I want to live. Well, Frost, Jarrell, and Larkin is a start.
It's a good start. How about Lowell?
Lowell is my younger, the mad self I never became, freelancing out along the razor's edge. That screwball might kill his wife, then take the pledge. No, not me, but I was reading those poems the year we were married. Marietta, my wife, and I were married. That screwball might kill his wife and take the pledge. So that was...
And she said, please read Robert Frost, right? My answer is, used to be Frost, I think. That is, if I could perceive the world the way Frost perceives it, I would be larger.
Did you come to Amherst feeling that way, or was that
post-Amherst? No, I didn't come to Amherst having read an awful lot of modern poetry, because it wasn't done in graduate school. Mm-hmm. You know, I came as a 17th century type, and I've not stopped being a 17th century type of a sort, at least in the classroom. But maybe this is a good place to say this. You've been very generous to me in ways, and one of the ways you were is that when you were teaching all of the 20th century poets, and I came to you one day a long time ago now, must be a quarter of a century ago, and said, do you think we could split these and I could do half? And you said, sure.
And there was enough for both of us. And now.
And we're still doing it. Although we used to do it British and American, I remember. Now we're doing it, dividing it in the middle of the 20th century.
Change back.
Would you be willing to talk a little about some people, not people in the book, but people that had something to do with the book? For example, editors. I mean, you're writing for a lot of different editors.
I used to, although most of the sources now have dried up, as the newspapers have hard times. But the most important one was Frederick Morgan and his wife, and now editor of the magazine since his death, the Hudson Review. And they've, from the very beginning, from 19, 67 it was when I wrote. I spoke inaccurately here, by the way, I realize. When I said, 50 years ago, I published my first essay. No! In my copy, I crossed 50 years out and written decades ago. But it was 1967, it was on the instigation of Morgan, who said, how would you like to take a look at some of the volumes of new poetry that have been published over the last quarter, over the last 3 months? And I was very excited, and I've told this story too many times maybe, but I said, sure, and the idea was to write something called an omnibus review or fiction chronicle, string them into a little progression that had some point. But the exciting thing was to have the 30 or so books, thin volumes, arrive, stack them up on the mantelpiece and think, I'm getting paid, and then to winnow them down to maybe 10 or so, and to take pot shots at poets whom I thought were overrated or pretentious or doing too well by the public, and to maybe uncover, or at least to pay heed to some who had not been so uncovered and discovered. And that was very heady, and I did that for a long time, and then for one reason or another, I sort of stopped. They stopped asking me to do volumes of poetry. They had a lot of younger people, I think, and our tastes didn't always converge. So I haven't done so much of that recently, but certainly they were instrumental to Hudson. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of getting some editor like the fine David Sanders who accepted, if I can say a word about the publication of this. I was dealing with another press who had encouraged me and had sent the books out to readers and so on, and the readers' reports were fine, and then came back the word, we've decided it's not marketable. Well, who ever thought that a book of essays on poets and poetry by anyone less than, Joseph Brodsky or Richard Wilbur would be marketable. So I spoke to a friend of mine, Brooke Allen, who's a wonderful reviewer and critic, and she said, I'm having a similar trouble getting some sucker, she said, to publish my collection of essays. Well, I thought then of David Sanders, who had done this nice Festschrift volume, which you and Chip Tucker edited, and wrote him a note, and he came back to me in about 3 days and said, I'd be pleased to publish this. And Ohio University Press, I take it, has, most university presses have to send the volumes out, but they have this Swallow Press, and I guess he pretty much has absolute authority over that. So I was terribly lucky and terribly pleased that he was willing to do this, and with a minimum of interference and fussing, except in helpful ways.
Yeah, I found him terrific when we were doing the Festschrift. Yeah. A nice footnote to that tale is that it turns out that this book is selling quite a few copies, thanks not only to its quality, but the fact that it got a prominent review in the Wall Street Journal, a month ago. And did you hear from him? Did you tell me, if I remember this right, that the books were flying off the shelves?
Well, that was a little bit of I'd ordered some more copies, and they said, we can't supply any because after the Wall Street Journal's review, the books flew off the shelf. Well, this is an understatement. Now, Dan Brown, I believe, sold a million
before publication.
And the print run for this was, I think, maybe less than 1,000. So it's not selling like hot. And that may be the last, may very well be the last review. It was a good review, and I appreciate it.
Yeah,
respect
it was.
The man who wrote it for his taste and authority.
Got things right. What are you working on next, do you think?
I don't know what. As the opportunity arises, I keep writing for Hudson, more or less write for every issue, which is and to write about writers I haven't written about before, like Hazlitt. I did Hazlitt recently, and I did E.M. Forster as a broadcaster recently, mm-hmm. and I've just done a piece for them on Elizabeth Taylor. Not, as you see, not very many poets. Mm-hmm. And I don't have, if somebody would say, and I've been waiting for years for it to happen, wouldn't you like to do a nice short book of 100 pages on Jonathan Swift or on William Wordsworth or whoever, I'd say sure, but they don't ask, and mine is not the kind of mind, alas, mind that has one project percolating and ready to get on the fire as soon as the last one is finished.
Yeah.
So that I've depended, except for the book on Updike, over the last 15 years, on being able, on finding an editor willing. Bruce Wilcox at University Press has been the main one here, mm-hmm. To consider a collection of recently, or most recently, mostly recently reprinted, already printed reviews. And some editors will say, well, we can't do that if they're already in print. Yes, they are, but they're not between covers, and how are you going to know about them anyway? It makes a difference,
for sure.
I think.
Yeah. No, it's a coherent
so,
book.
So I guess I can't say any more than that.
Well, you're not slowing down, it doesn't sound. I'm glad to hear. I could imagine that some people listening to this little conversation might be interested in hearing something about Amherst College and the Amherst English Department. I haven't been put up to this by Betsy Cannon Smith, my friend, or anybody, a former student too, or anybody else, but I was reflecting on, as one might, and possibly somebody whose name I'm going to speak here, although they're not living, most of them, two of them are. When you think of the fact that in the Amherst College graduating class years 1942 to 1953, those boundaries I set because Richard Wilbur was in the class of 42 and you and Bill Youngren were in the class of 1953, some really major poets and critics were educated at Amherst College and in the English department. Wilbur, David Ferry, James Merrill, Richard Poirier, you, Youngren, I'm
put
sure.
Put the years, poets, a couple of years ahead, and we got Bob Bagg, who's just
that's right,
out
class
with a
of
new
57.
Collection.
That's right.
Writing a biography of Wilbur.
That's right. What was in the air? How did it happen?
Youngren said, my good late friend, once to me, the 50s was a good time to study English. And nobody's ever put it to me quite like that before, but I think he was right. At least it was a good time to study what we thought was English. That is, the close acquaintance and perusal with the performances of major and minor works in Anglo-American literature, and that's where the action was, and that's where the teaching was directed, and. It in a way, like the new curriculum in Amherst, it enabled a kind of attentiveness and concentration, because there weren't a hell of a lot of other things you could do. Joe Barber, Caesar Barber, who taught Joyce at the college, also taught a course in Yeats and Eliot. But that in 1952, that. Not quite far-fetched, but that was as far into the 20th century
yeah.
as
yeah.
Anybody had gone. And I don't know. Well, I do know. It certainly didn't have anything to do with rigorous historical study or learning the canon or literary history, very little of that. Mm-hmm. But it did have to do with a habit of mind, a habit of taking sentences seriously, and especially with Brower's influence, but with Barber and Craig and Baird too, and with Frost behind them all, a deference to the ear, to ear reading, to saying that the best part of reading, Frost exaggerates, is what you hear when it's imaginative mm-hmm. literature. not just see. And that those permanent truths are still the ones I and you, I think, live by.
Sure, I do.
And they were just coming into their prime in the 1950s. That's one try to answer it.
That's a good.
The only other answer would be that there just were a lot of sheer geniuses around.
Well, I thought, you know, obviously a very, very fine, small faculty of literary people at this college.
Yes.
in the 1950s. I didn't come until 1965, and so I only knew in that group you've just named, Baird, and not well him, because he retired not too long after I started, and Craig, who was in his later years.
And we must not leave out Benjamin DeMott.
Well, I'm not going to leave out Benjamin DeMott, who was not your undergraduate teacher, right?
No, he could have been, though. He came.
Did he come in your last year?
He came when I was a junior, but I never took a course with him, and he was teaching mainly staff courses, but he made an immediate, terrific impact.
Well, I would think.
As a teacher.
Yeah. Well, for what it's worth, inspired me as much as anybody. Ever. I was thinking also, though, that the admissions office must have been very shrewd in those days. Was Bill Wilson the dean
yes,
of admission
indeed.
When
and
you were?
He's responsible. Quick story. As you know, David, I applied to your university, Princeton, and they had the temerity to turn me down.
Well, you were too young, Bill.
I was too young, and we wept and so on, and what were we going to do? And my father wrote a letter to Dean Wilson at Amherst and put my case, and this was the middle of May. And I didn't get it. Wilson said, send his college boards along, and if they're good, he's in. And I got the official letter of admission, I think, the first week in June. I don't think Bill Wilson looked out particularly for good English students. Well, maybe he did.
Have.
Maybe he did.